judged me negatively and decided I was a jerk during that time and calmly explained what transpired from my point of view. But that's not how this world works, does it? Anyway, I was feeling extremely down. The worst part was that I felt like much of it was by my own sword, which made me feel doubly bad, because I always thought of myself as a somewhat clever person who doled out advice rather than someone who was unhappy and desperately seeking it. After all this, I started talking to a shrink at the insistence of a good friend. Friends were worried about me. Hell, I was worried about me. The shrink and I talked on the phone for an hour as I sat in a Harris Teeter grocery store parking lot. We talked about life. We talked about drugs and alcohol, which I know I've touted a bit here in this audiobook. I certainly have had more than a few instances where drugs and alcohol have been my worst enemy and given me a false sense of being bulletproof. It made me think I was brilliant when I was actually being boorish. We also talked about other things I was passionate about, and the fact that for some, boredom can lead to poor decision-making, especially when you're on a show that films 4 months a year, and then you have a ton of free time. It's a potentially dangerous situation because you feel like, hey, I made another season. Who cares what happens next? Idle hands are a devil's workshop, as they say. I started to tell the shrink about a few things I was thinking about and working on, and he remarked how my whole persona changed when I talked about those projects, and he suggested that I focus on those things. He also wanted to know whether I even cared about negative press, which I found interesting, because I guess the old dictum of any press is good press gets in people's minds as a defense mechanism. I think he sensed that I didn't relish bad press, and he was right. Again, I go back to my childhood days when I learned that being rambunctious was okay, but being a bad egg was not. The thought of bringing embarrassment to my family and friends is just devastating and appalling to me. That's not to say it hasn't happened. I thought the conversation with the shrink was constructive, but I was also a bit embarrassed about the stigma that therapy brings with it in some people's minds. I'm reminded of a scene in Crocodile Dundee where Sue tells Mick about a woman in New York City who benefited from psychiatry. And he said something like, "Doesn't she have any mates?" That's how I saw it for a long time. If you have a bunch of good friends and a loving family, why would you need to talk to a third party? Then I heard a Conan O'Brien podcast with Howard Stern. They were both very open and honest about how much therapy has helped them in their lives. And those are two of my heroes. So that gave me pause. It occurred to me that because a therapist is a third party is the exact reason that they are valuable. They don't have a dog in the fight. They're completely objective. And they are trained professionals with tools that can help you in certain situations. With your family and friends, they know you and you know them. If they mention something critical, you could get defensive and say, "Well, what about you?" It's imperative to just have a sounding board, I think, especially during tough times. I ended up finding an ongoing therapist in Charleston, and she's been a big help. Without going into too much detail, her advice can best be condensed into the old Johnny Mercer song, "Accentuate the Positive." Be more strategic, without being conniving. Sometimes retreat a little to advance later. Jesus, it sounds like I'm describing Sun Tzu's military tome, "The Art of War." But the therapist listened to me, and I think gathered that I was engaging and happy, but that I had produced a lot of anxieties due to stupid, often show-related quarrels. And a lot of it was because of my impulsiveness and passion. With success comes frustration and headbutting and horn-locking with others. I was also acting spoiled because things have gone my way a lot in life. Looking back, I even see getting kicked out of school as a positive. But then again, rationalizing poor behavior and missteps by saying it's part of my journey, bro, is irresponsible and fake spiritual. Now the stakes are much higher, and so my awareness must grow with that. I have to rise above pettiness. I love the saying, "Don't wrestle with the pig, you just get dirty and the pig enjoys it." That was my interpretation of her advice. I sound like a bad self-help guru. The trick is to come out looking like Wilbur from Charlotte's Web, totally innocent and spared from the slaughterhouse. Anyway, the therapist and I talked about season 7 of Southern Charm, and I expressed trepidation about wanting to do it again, since I felt like I didn't come out of the 6th season looking my best. Each season I have to take stock of how things went. Sometimes you come out looking like a villain, and sometimes you're the court jester, which is my favorite. But that season I felt like a villain. I try not to listen to the hate on social media, but I wouldn't be human if it didn't wear me down at times. So I always have to gauge whether it's worth doing the next season. The therapist made me do a pros and cons list, and wouldn't you know it, the pros won. I'm not sure if that'll always be the case, but for now, that's the score. We also talk about my attitudes and decisions in my romantic life, and I discovered that I always get pessimistic and assume relationships will end, despite the fact that my parents have had a long and happy marriage. I get anxiety about relationships ending or hearts getting broken, and she said something that really opened my eyes. She said, "Do you think you're the only one who has anxiety about relationships, who doesn't wonder what might happen if they meet someone else? This is universal and it's a fact of life. Life is unpredictable, especially when you add another person." Of course, she's 100% right. It's a philosophical theory many have expressed, but I like this description from the writer Claudia Gray the best. We are all the center of our own universe, and all of us in someone else's orbit. It's a paradox, but sometimes paradoxes are where the truth begins. If I didn't mention before, I'm a huge fan of the truth. So despite what it might look like on the show or on social media from time to time, I think about being fair and decent to everyone I come across. Sometimes I succeed, sometimes not. Sometimes not being an asshole takes work. Maybe Mr. Murray was just partly right with his equation. Maybe it takes a little longer than 2 years to figure out how not to be an asshole. Maybe it takes 6.5 years. Maybe it takes really examining yourself and trying to achieve some sort of zen about this strange world that you inhabit, whether that world is played out on TV or not. Maybe to riff on Alexander Pope, to be an asshole is human, to figure out how not to be an asshole is divine. When Bill Murray and his castmates started up at SNL, there wasn't Twitter, Instagram, or Us Weekly, although there have always been tabloids. I love to see some footage of their insane parties with Keith Richards, David Bowie, and Robin Williams. I'm sure it was totally low-key and no one acted like an asshole ever. The terrain is just a lot rockier and fraught with peril these days, with potential landmines, aka social media, everywhere. Honestly, I would be suspicious of anyone who has been in the public eye for any amount of time who hasn't faced some sort of embarrassing moment or minor scandal. Even a saint like Tom Hanks was embroiled in a minor semi-scandal when he was quarantined with coronavirus in Australia and he shared a video of himself eating Vegemite on toast, causing Aussies to blow up at him because he didn't have the correct Vegemite to bread ratio on his toast. Everyone has demons and skeletons. The more you try to suppress and hide them, the stronger they become and the more the soup comes to a violent boil. You have to acknowledge and understand those demons so you can see them looming on the horizon. I'm not saying I'm an expert at this, but I am trying, and it has been more than 2 years since I've been in the public eye, so to speak. So according to Bill Murray's asshole equation, my time for being a true asshole is up. In honor of the asshole equation, I present to you my official list of the best/worst assholes in film and TV history, so you can learn from their mistakes. And also go back and watch some great shows. Number 1. Johnny from Karate Kid. The actor is named William Zabka. His friends supposedly call him Billy. And my friends and I are obsessed with him. The guy was also in National Lampoon's European Vacation, where he bangs Audrey's best friend and utters the famous phrase, "I miss the shit out of you." Anyway, in Karate Kid, he's the rich asshole who is just a major bully towards Daniel LaRusso. The new guy, the little guy, the freaking Karate Kid. A few things in defense of Johnny. LaRusso was chasing after his ex-girlfriend, so that was a cause for tension. Also, if you look closely during the bathroom scene, Johnny is actually sitting on the toilet rolling a joint. I missed that detail for many years. And Daniel douses him with water, ruining the weed. Not cool. At the very end, Johnny actually insists on giving Daniel the trophy, so like many of us, he may be a redeemable asshole. The real villain in the movie is actually Cobra Kai Dojo Sensei John Kreese, who created the atmosphere of bullying and general assholeness that Johnny was reared in. The actor's name is Martin Cove, and I'm also obsessed with him, to the point where, during college, I made a website in his honor. The website was devoted to finding Martin Cove more work, and we had no clue what we were doing. So it was really just a bunch of photos of him in Karate Kid and Commando. It's a safe bet that our rudimentary online resume didn't land the guy any roles. Anyway, In Karate Kid, he was teaching all those kids to be little pricks and show no mercy. They were so impressionable, and it's all his fault. They had to unlearn how to be assholes. Fuck him. The lesson here is, behind every asshole, there might be an even bigger asshole. Number 2. King Edward Longshanks from Braveheart. This guy insists that all the English lords in Scotland have sex with newly married brides. He also fires arrows into his own troops. And he kills his son's boyfriend. Anti-gay medieval kings can go fuck themselves. But what a brilliant piece of acting. Lesson: don't discriminate and don't shoot arrows at your friends. It's rude. Number 3. King Joffrey and Ramsay from Game of Thrones. This one is a tie. Although I wanted to absolutely beat the shit out of Joffrey every time he was on screen, I was legit scared of Ramsay. Apparently, I wasn't the only one. Supposedly, the guy who played Joffrey took a break from acting and literally had to hide from the public because people thought he was that asshole character. That sucks because that's really a testament to how well he crushed the role. Lesson: being an asshole can ruin your career. Number 4. Walter Peck in Ghostbusters. In honor of Bill Murray, this is the Ghostbusters villain who releases all the ghosts into New York City. The actor also plays the opportunistic idiot sabotaging reporter in Die Hard and Die Hard 2. I'm noticing a trend here. All these guys are pretty good actors, judging by the fact that years later, I still spend a lot of time thinking how much of a dick they are / were. Lesson: don't be a dick and don't unleash any ghosts. Number 5. Sawyer from Lost. God, I hated this guy. I despised him for many reasons. The biggest one being that he is able to seduce Kate, Evangeline Lilly, who I was extremely smitten with and who I wanted Jack to end up with. A hot dude villain is a fun role to play, I bet. I actually met Josh Holloway, who played Sawyer, at an NBC event. I must admit, despite my hatred of his character, I was like a little fangirl. His charisma just drew me in, so I get it, Kate. You are forgiven. Lesson: assholes can be charismatic as fuck. Southern Charm bios. When Southern Charm began, we were asked to write a short bio for the Bravo.com website. I think I rightly assumed that not many viewers were curious enough to go to the website and dig deeper about a bunch of strangers in Charleston. And after watching a few early episodes, many of you were probably scared about what you'd find out. I took the bio as a challenge to be as silly and outrageous as I possibly could, and to show off some writing chops. And remember, I didn't even know if the show would last past one season, so what did I have to lose? The bio gave my friends in the Bravo offices some joy, and they claimed to like it. I'm not sure how many fans comb Bravo.com for Southern Charm bios, though, so here they are for a hopefully wider audience. These bios also give me the chance to write about myself in the third person, which is a wildly absurd thing to do. Think of them as my early flirtation with literary greatness. Season 1. This was just a Q&A. When they asked me to list my occupation, I wrote raconteur. Season 2. Over years passed since we've last seen Mr. Shepherd Shep Rose navigating the sometimes turbulent waters of the great city of Charleston. While he hasn't changed, he has definitely evolved. Shep is still his roguish and irreverent self. However, time has softened some rough edges and allowed him to cultivate a number of endeavors. He's opened up a new restaurant and bar called the Palace Hotel that serves gourmet hot dogs, tacos, and cold beverages in an off-the-beaten-path neighborhood in downtown Charleston. He also built a home in the same neighborhood and has begun renovations on an old nightclub nearby that should be ready this spring. He's finally, after 35 years on this earth, starting to understand the basic tenets of adulthood. These may be the self-proclaimed halcyon days for Mr. Rose. However, he is also aware of the old dictum: just when you think you have it all figured out, the rug is pulled out from under you. So Shep intends to remain vigilant, expose fraud, and fight injustice. In short, he will not rest on his laurels. Season 3. Almost 3 years have passed since we first met Mr. Rose. Many questions have been answered and curiosity satiated. However, do we really know the real Shep? Does anyone? Is he the fast-talking charlatan with the depth of a rain puddle, or an intelligent, thoughtful, and supportive denizen of the booming metropolis of Charleston? Does he even know the answers to these questions? What we do know is that the ship, Shep, is on course and maintaining current cruising speed. Wind in its sails, booty secured in the galley, no doldrums on the horizon for this journey. Traveling remains a passion, as does socializing. One may ask if this sort of peripatetic life wears thin on a man. Shep would answer emphatically, no, it never does, and hopefully never will, for a rolling stone gathers no moss. Season 4. For this bio, the higher-ups at Bravo asked me if I had any changes to my last bio. And my reply was, you're goddamn right I have some changes. This is my favorite assignment of the year. As we approach season 4, it should be noted that there are 4 seasons in a calendar year. Thus, if analyzed cyclically, Mr. Shepherd Rose has indeed come full circle. Ergo, season 1 began in the summer. So now we find him in the spring of his television existence. Indeed, Mr. Rose is in full bloom. As the old saying goes, the whole is greater than the sum of its parts. Shep happily plays the part of court jester in this amalgam ensemble of colorful characters that is Southern charm. However, this season Shep grapples with the Falstaffian illusion that the joviality of a clown often masks a certain sadness and avoidance of responsibility and accountability. However, his acknowledgement of this looming identity shows a self-awareness that may allow him to get ahead of the curve and make the necessary adjustments in order to avoid cliched pitfalls and double binds. This season, without revealing too much, we see Shep living downtown in the house he built last year, enjoying all the tomfoolery that bar ownership affords and seems to invite. Indeed, good times are had. Women, wine, and song will get you every time, though. And Shep is wondering if the late nights and mornings are taking their toll. Is the love of a good and honest woman the answer and salve that can bring him back from the fringe? Perhaps, but he will not compromise and settle for anything less than true love. For why settle down when you can settle up at the bar? Season 5. Believe it or not, we are entering the 5th season of Southern Charm. It is similar to the 5th dimension, which was an attempt to develop a theory that unifies the 4 fundamental forces of nature: strong and weak nuclear forces, gravity, and electromagnetism. For Southern Charm has largely propagated the properties of physics: inertia, pressure, gravity, the bending of time. We have seen this cast of characters develop in front of our very eyes. Like a gentle tide, many have surged and receded to the delight and or dismay of those around them and viewers at home alike. And now, as Shakespeare so eloquently wrote about war, once more unto the breach, dear friends, once more. Not that this is the final season, although it could be. Alas, Mr. Rose is just a player upon a stage. This year has Mr. Shepherd Rose in a state of sedation. He put his heart out into the harsh and unforgiving climate of deep romance, and it tragically yielded to the elements. So now he sits in his lonely castle of solitude on the shores of the Atlantic, plotting his return and regaining his strength. Through it all, Mr. Rose is surprisingly pleased with how life has brought him to this nexus. He's coming to grips with the fact that he's no longer a young man, but he also realizes that he'll never lose that adolescent spark and roguish spirit. So now he must find a balance, and he believes that this current lifestyle is the beginning of a new and exciting chapter. He has scars and he will not hide them. At the risk of sounding trite, he will pick his spots and keep things simple, all while continuing to strive for happiness and extemporaneous adventure. Season 6. Relationship was a nickname bestowed upon Mr. Shepherd Rose in the year AD 2003. Although not fully domesticated, could Mr. Rose for once care about someone other than himself? One would think his closest comrades would evoke happiness and admiration for his newfound condition. However, their forked tongue revealed itself as they lamented the absence of the affable idiot they once knew. But alas, nothing lasts forever, and Shep Rose, like a phoenix from the ashes, returned to his friend's hilarious and sophomoric bosom, where the tomfoolery, debauchery, and patently asinine camaraderie persisted for many years. Many years have passed and good times had. We now find Mr. Rose's cohorts married with families. No longer does laughter bellow down the hallways of the dormitory of life. The same jokes fall on different ears. It's all been done before. The once spontaneous has become mundane. Mr. Rose is starting to feel as if his old moniker relationship beckons him to return to a simpler time, where love reigns supreme. He fondly remembers grocery shopping, good-naturedly ruining a lovely girl's attempt at preparing an edible meal, reluctantly agreeing to watch a stupid TV show that she likes, then secretly becoming obsessed with it. But where to look? Has he been riding on the prairie for too long, scanning the horizon for greener pastures in lieu of building on a plot of land that was fertile, defensible, and provided comfort and calmness? Has life passed Shep by? He'd answer, of course not, for the average life expectancy for American male is 78.74 years. Mr. Rose is almost on the back nine of life. He seeks change. He wishes to perhaps evolve and show himself and those around him that he is capable of maturation. He loves Charleston, but has all the good land been tilled? Perhaps it has. So he intends to heed Horace Greeley's famous proclamation and supplication, "Go west, young man." Manifest destiny just might be the answer for Mr. Rose, for he will seek his better half on the roads leading out of his home state and pray that it has not become a trail of tears. Season 7. Redemption is a word, nay, a concept, that has been around since the dinosaurs. It means our sins are washed away, down into the drain, trickling to the nearest river, and eventually finding their way to the Cape of Good Hope. The result is a naked person, clean and reborn, nervous but sanguine. This is where we find Mr. Shep Rose at the dawn of Season 7. He has suffered the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, mostly self-inflicted wounds, which sting the most. But here he is, wiser, humbled, determined to right the wrongs and evolve into a man in full. Although we've heard this rhetoric in the past, Shep realizes that sometimes you must lose it all to really gain enlightenment. At least he thinks he remembers reading that in the book Siddhartha. Little Craig, the dog, has been a shining beacon of happiness and joy, not only to Shep, but to the whole fair city of Charleston. For how can life be burdensome when that furry little stalwart is waiting in the wings, wanting to play and eat treats? In a twist almost no one saw coming, least of all Mr. Rose, there has been a new member of the team added last winter, for he has found a young woman who has made his little heart sing. Without revealing too much, she is kind, beautiful, and has a boatload of patience and understanding, the latter being very important. Shep will enter this season contrite, centered, happy, and more than willing to mend any fence and even create newer and stronger alliances. He is not naked and afraid. He is naked and dating. Oh, and redeemed, depending on who you talk to. Chapter 6. Oliver Twist. There are two types of men in this world. You're either a Jeff Bridges or a Leonardo DiCaprio. Not to say that either path is right or wrong, but the contrast is stark. I'll start with Jeff. He's the son of actor Lloyd Bridges, who is a serious actor until he appeared in the Airplane franchise and Hot Shots, where he displayed amazing straight man plays a fool comedic acting chops. He and Leslie Nielsen are two of my favorites. Their slapstick skills are Oscar-worthy, and I could talk about their comedy skills for hours, but I'll spare you my armchair movie commentary. Let's get back to Jeff. As the son of a famous actor and a really handsome dude, Google his early work. Chicks dug him. Jeff Bridges probably could have cut a wide swath through Hollywood and had flings with any babe he wanted. And honestly, I don't know what he did until 1975, when he was only 26, when he met a gal who was waitressing in Montana, where he was shooting a film. He married her and had three daughters, and by all accounts, he is the most normal family man you'd ever want to meet. This is actually confirmed by some of my San Francisco friends, the ones I had such a good time with when I was toothless in Sonoma. One of their buddies married one of Jeff's daughters, and they went to the wedding. Besides Jackson Brown playing at the reception, they said it was completely down to earth and everyone was cool, including Jeff. My point about him is that he chose to walk a path that many others do, which on its surface doesn't seem earth-shattering. I mean, people stay married all the time, actually more like 50% of the time. But to do it while being wildly successful in an industry surrounded by beautiful people just begging to sleep with you does deserve a tip of the cap. I mean, temptation is a motherfucker. Imagine having T-bone steaks dangled in front of you at all times, but you continue to eat chicken. Why would you do that if you love steak and lobster and potatoes au gratin and salmon and braised lamb? Damn it, now I'm hungry. I do hate to objectify women by comparing them to food, but I'm fine with women saying that guys are a hunk. Of what? I'm not sure. Hamburger meat? What about calling a guy a beefcake? Not that anyone under 60 years old uses that term anymore, but still. My point is, I'm not trying to objectify women, and if a woman made an analogy about me, I would hope it would have to do with a sirloin or beef Wellington. I like the pastry crust. Maybe I'm fighting a losing battle here, though, so let's move on. I have a theory that might help explain the Jeff Bridges type of guy. Many all-time great athletes are married and start a family young, and they go on to excel at a very high level. I wonder if there's a correlation. Once you take chasing girls and carrying on with your friends out of the equation, you probably fall into an old routine and gravitate towards practicing your craft, if for no other reason than to get the hell out of the house. Tennis greats Roger Federer, Rafael Nadal, and Novak Djokovic have all been with the same woman virtually their whole career, and that stability and routine might play a part in their success. I'm not a scientist or psychologist, but I believe my theory is 100% true. Look at other athletic stalwarts. LeBron James, Michael Jordan, Steph Curry, Dwayne Wade, Peyton Manning, Joe Montana, and Jack Nicklaus all married their high school or college girlfriends or got married early in their career. They might not still be with them now, and their marriages may not have been perfect, but they were married early. Now, the other guys who enjoy the spoils of fame like free booze and plentiful women, I doubt they had the staying power that the aforementioned guys had. The prime example is NFL champ Joe Namath, a notorious drinker and Lothario. Yes, he won one of the most famous Super Bowls of all time, but if you look at his career statistics, his numbers aren't that great. Did you know that he threw 173 touchdowns and had 220 interceptions? His one outstanding season is why he's remembered with such admiration. That, and all the women he betted. But my point is that he didn't have, say, 10 seasons of glory, possibly because he never settled down until he was 41 years old, which is ancient in football years. Look at Tom Brady, married. My point is that I have an unscientific theory linking athletic glory and marriage, and I'm sticking to it. On the opposite end of the spectrum from the Jeff Bridges of the world, we have Leonardo DiCaprio. He gained stardom at an early age since he's a gifted actor. He forms a small group of friends, and they call themselves the Pussy Posse, which is incredibly douchey, but so were they, probably. Think about it. You're a drama major slash actor as a kid and teen, so you definitely weren't cool as a theater kid. Not like the quarterback of the football team. In fact, you probably got your ass kicked by the quarterback. These guys longingly stared at the prom queen, hoping and wishing that somehow they would be attracted to them and their love of acting. No such luck. Until the Titanic hits the iceberg and then it's on. So post-Titanic, imagine that young Leo has got some catching up to do. Suddenly all the doors slash women are unlocked. Who can blame you for walking or sleeping your way through them? You'd be crazy not to. And maybe my theory of success in marriage has just been blown to pieces by Leo DiCaprio. Because he's in his 40s and he's notorious for never settling down and only dating younger models. And he's crazy successful. For the record, I thought his Oscar-winning movie The Revenant was good, not great. But it was so beautiful to look at, it inspired me to book a trip to Alaska. Like I said, I'm not a psychologist or a scientist. I'm just a guy trying to solve the eternal riddle that is commitment. Also, I know I boldly said there were two different types of men in the world, but actually there might be a third type. The George Clooney, Derek Jeter, Warren Beatty guy. The proud bachelor who eventually settles down. Yes, take away their many accomplishments and talents, and these guys are me. All of them excel in their professional and private lives, which is to say, their incredibly enviable private exploits didn't seem to interfere with their careers. But that has nothing to do with me. I don't really have or want a career. It's their approach and philosophy of life and love that maybe I've subconsciously adopted. From where I sit, it looks to me like these guys realize that life is short. Check that. They realize that life is long and women are everywhere. I doubt any of these guys had any trouble with women at any point in their lives, but they saw no reason to rush into a legally binding contract with anyone or to have little kids running around taking away their freedom to live life to the fullest and to travel and to have guiltless, spontaneous romances, to be footloose and fancy free, a girl in every port. If it ain't broke, don't fix it. For a rolling stone gathers no moss. The road to excess leads to the palace of wisdom. Insert the lyrics to Lynyrd Skynyrd's Freebird. You get what I mean. These men sucked the marrow out of life and left no stone unturned. They gallivanted around the world and made memories that we mortal men could only dream about. They dated women who were on the cover of every magazine on earth, which has to be intoxicating. And they didn't apologize to anyone. Hell, Beatty had a hit song written partially about him called You're So Vain by Carly Simon. But here's the kicker. They all settled down eventually. They understood that perhaps life isn't truly enriching without a family. I have another theory, because in Shepland, there is ample time to dream up theories. I think we were put on this earth for a very short time, and we were meant to have fun. But it's undeniable that we were also, at least originally, put here to propagate our species. Now, we could get into topics like overpopulation and ill-advised excess procreation, but I'll spare you. But I believe people when they say that having a child is the best thing they've ever done with their lives. I've never had one, but I understand the logic. What could be cooler than creating a little facsimile of yourself, who you then have a chance to actually fine-tune to become an even better version? And then you get to watch them flourish and then fall and get back up. What an unmitigated thrill ride that must be. I also believe that if there is a God or higher power, he or she didn't want us to come here and chase our every desire and whim, and to live like early Roman emperors Caligula and Nero, who were disgusting in their excess. No palace of wisdom for you assholes. I think that we were meant to learn sacrifice and restraint at some point in our lives. In essence, and to steal Tom Wolfe's novel's name, to become a man in full. From where I sit, I predict that in 50 years, marriage as we know it will be unrecognizable. The institution won't go extinct, but it'll be endangered. Granted, there will always be traditionalists who hearken back to the old days and yearn for simpler times. These are the people who also try to slow tourism in Charleston, too late for that, and bemoan the end of VHS tapes. Though I empathize and somewhat agree with them, the horses are out of the barn, the train has left the station. Charleston is repeatedly named one of the top cities in the country by Condé Nast. Did we think no one was paying attention? And the olden days are done. What will cohabitation and marriage look like in the future? I believe it will become more of a self-defined partnership. It'll be more pragmatic and less idealistic. Because let's face it, it's fucking hard to be in a relationship. Being single is easy as pie. Attaching yourself to another human being is hard work, which is why I have headed into my 40s as an unmarried man, like Warren Beatty and George Clooney, without the Oscars. Dating sites and the internet are no friends of traditional marriage either. I mean, there are even dating sites for married people. There are sites for sugar daddies, geeks, people who love Star Trek, or farmers only. Maybe I should start a dating app for seniors called Carbon Dating. The point is, the ability to connect with anyone you want is just insane. The interconnectivity means you can be in Maine and find and interact with someone in Washington State who has the same little proclivities and idiosyncrasies that you do. Or meet three people a week who have your exact same taste in music. With so many options, why would you settle? In the past, you met a local girl or guy, and you liked him, and you were compatible, and you're getting to a certain age, and you just threw your hands up and pulled the trigger. I'm nothing if not romantic. Some couples claim that it was love at first sight, or S-I-T-E sight, and their relationship just blossomed ever since. I don't buy that. There's a great Chris Rock stand-up line that comes to mind. Men do not settle down, men surrender. It's tongue-in-cheek, but mostly true. I think Chris Rock did end up getting divorced, so surrender isn't always permanent. Guys love thinking they still have it after they commit and fantasizing that they are semi-available. if the situation presents itself. That's wishful thinking. Of course, I can't speak for all women or even one woman, but I sense that they like getting dolled up from time to time so they can walk into a bar or restaurant and feel beautiful or desirable, even if they're in a relationship. I once believed that women were more loyal and less promiscuous than men, but Lord have mercy, Instagram has opened my eyes. Women are just as scandalous and amorous as men, and then some. I'm all for it. I wish I knew that some women felt this way when I was a late bloomer coming into my own. I thought girls were like a safe you had to unlock. That's better than comparing them to food, right? And they were always on the defense. It was almost like boys had to be on their best behavior and wait patiently until a girl was ready to get physical. Boy, was I wrong. Or maybe I was right. Maybe this is just the result of a great liberation or a slow erosion of the stigma against promiscuity. Maybe it was Sex and the City that changed it all. Whatever it is that helped women become more in-your-face sexually, I fully support it. Well-behaved women rarely make history, right? Damn it, I'm speaking in platitudes again, but that's a good one. Before you tear me to shreds about my observations, let me clarify. I realize that to many girls, this notion of sleeping around or one-night stand seems incomprehensible. That's fine, because to each their own. But for me, when I hear of the high school sweethearts who get married young, it makes me shake my head in disgust. Just kidding, but it does make me skeptical. Yes, on one level it's admirable, but also having sex with one person? Come on. Variety is the spice of life. And also different experiences make you value the person you end up with, I think. This isn't the 1950s, thank God. I'm not judging anyone who wants to wait to settle down. How could I? Men or women. I am all for equal rights when it comes to sleeping around until the last possible moment, or until you finally meet your Annette or Amal. I was talking to an acquaintance recently who has a daughter in her early teens, and I was inquiring about college and whether he's nervous for her to start that next phase. Since as men, we know how some college guys think. His answer was, "Man, of course I am, but I raised her well, and obviously I don't want to know any details, but I trust her to gain experience and hopefully choose the right person and maybe choose the wrong one a couple times because that's all part of it." This made total sense to me. It's not like in today's world you can be the dad with a pitchfork or a shotgun waiting for your little girl to be dropped off at 11 p.m. sharp. That will definitely not fly with a teenage girl on Instagram. By the way, I reserve the right to change my tune if and when I have a daughter. I may suddenly start believing that no one should have sex until marriage, but time will tell. On that note, here's another line from Chris Rock's stand-up that's a little more complicated. Men are only as faithful as their options. This one is a matter of faithfulness and character in many instances, but it's also real, due to a four-letter word spelled L-U-S-T. Lust is a powerful, undeniable force. It drives us to make some stupid decisions and also allows us to experience pure bliss at times. It should not and cannot be ignored. Again, unless I one day have a daughter, in which case she can ignore lust all she wants. When it comes to options, there's also the matter of the one-night stand, which seems to mean different things to different people. I was with a group of people once and we were playing an infantile card game that doubled as a drinking game. I hated the game, but I participated nonetheless. We were supposed to raise our hand if we've ever had a one-night stand. One very cute girl did not raise her hand, but then she proceeded to sleep with a guy at the table that very night, and they haven't repeated the act since. A week later, I was hanging out with one of her girlfriends, and I said, "I guess she has to raise her hand now since she had a one-night stand." To my surprise, her girlfriend said that her friend's postcard game tryst didn't qualify as a one-night stand since she knew the guy she slept with. For the record, they were not close at all and had maybe met once before in passing. Call me insane, but to me that sounds like a one-night stand. I'm not judging at all. In fact, I was happy for both of them since I'm a firm believer in the ancient creed, if it feels good, do it. So I'm not sure why some people still stigmatize something like a one-night stand. Look at women like Cardi B, Rihanna, and Samantha from Sex and the City, who put their sexuality out there with no reservations and with no shame. And look how many women love them. They own their sexuality. Most women have many secrets to tell, and they love women who just put it all out there, and they love the memes that celebrate being sexual. And women, let me tell you, guys are here for it. I mean, I am. A one-night stand isn't something to be ashamed of, man or woman. Like I said, I diplomatically believe that both men and women should put off marriage as long as possible and have as much fun as they possibly can. Where I come from, there's still an old-school Southern attitude about marriage, which means get married at a respectable age, mainly before 40 for guys, have kids, and don't get divorced and shame the family name. My grandmother from Lake Forest, Illinois, asked my mom once if I was gay because I wasn't married by 35 years old. Obviously, gay couples can get married, but like I said, these are old school attitudes. And I have a friend who married a girl because he was pressured by his traditional Southern dad to make an honest woman out of her. They ended up being miserable, not because marriage makes everyone miserable, but because they weren't a good match. And they ended up divorcing and disappointing her parents and his. That's why I think traditional marriage is changing. People are saying to hell with the old school. I'm on this planet for a finite number of years, so I choose happiness and freedom over tradition. I understand that even the best relationships aren't always a walk in the park, and there will be tough times. But if those tough times took up 99% of the marriage, I would definitely pull the ripcord. Honestly, this has been the crux of my trepidation about marriage and settling down. I don't want to meticulously construct a new life that looks nothing like my current, relatively stress-free one, only to find that I'm miserable and that I have to tear the whole thing down. It's a big risk emotionally, reputationally, and to one's soul. Hurting someone else is terrifying to me. Turning their world upside down, having all their family and friends feel homicidal when your name is mentioned, I just don't want that. It's a disturbance in the force. Here's another thing that I've spoken to my therapist about. Usually in these situations, the writing is on the wall. But also, what if your family and friends stay close with your ex? I think I read that after Brad Pitt and Jennifer Aniston split up, Pitt's mom and Jennifer remained close and spoke all the time, which gives me hope. It means you don't have to destroy everything in the event of a breakup or a divorce, and that people can, sometimes, remain reasonable. The Aniston-Pitt story doesn't make me want to jump into marriage, but it does ease my fear, just a little. There's a famous quote by Henry David Thoreau, "Most men live lives of quiet desperation." That won't be me, I can promise you that. I'm very lucky that there hasn't been much pressure applied to me by my family in the marriage realm, besides my nana wondering if I was gay. Like I said before, my parents have been together for almost 50 years, so you would think that I would have a rosier view of marriage than some. I've never seen my parents get into a serious argument. I'm sure they've had a few, but never around their children. Well, there was this one time when we were in Paris for Thanksgiving when I was 36 years old, and my dad was so obnoxiously itinerary-based that everyone was a little on edge. It was me, my parents, plus my brother and sister-in-law, who was pregnant. He wanted us to wake up at 7 a.m., have breakfast from 8 to 10, the Louvre at 11 a.m., then head to Marseille by 2 p.m. His meticulous planning took the joy out of many of these wonderful cultural experiences. Now, there were only so many Clark Griswold jokes we could make before we started to get frustrated with this strict itinerary. My sister-in-law had just discovered that she was pregnant, so she stayed in with my brother most nights, which meant I spent much of my time with my parents. That is, when I wasn't prowling the streets on my own. My mom supported my dad and dutifully went on these excursions, and I ditched them. This was right after the terrible terrorist attacks in Paris, and I said, fuck museums. I want to walk around the city. It was sobering and enlightening seeing the city at that moment. There were little memorials and flowers in front of the concert venue that was attacked, and I also made it a point to go to the cafes that had been ambushed. As tragic and horrific as it was living history. And the Mona Lisa isn't going anywhere. I'm glad I walked the streets instead of staring at some monotonous group of paintings. Once you've seen 1,000 paintings, you're usually good. So we all meet back up, and it's our last day, and my dad breaks out the itinerary and says, well, let's have an early dinner because our flight is at 9 a.m., and we must leave for the airport at 5 a.m. This was the last straw. I said, under no circumstance would I be leaving that early, and my mom agreed. This was the last straw for Griswold. It was the first time I saw my parents get into an argument, albeit a pretty small one. But what happened next made my heart melt, and it's usually icy cold, although I do cry in movies literally all the time. See the list following this chapter if you don't believe me. Ignoring my dad's calls for a 5 a.m. departure time, we jumped into a taxi and headed to a cool bar I was told about in Paris. My parents weren't speaking because the squabble was fresh, so I sat between them making jokes and trying to break the ice. We got to the bar, and as soon as we walked in, we were totally fish out of water. Well, they were, at least. It was like an old pawn shop turned bar, the kind of place with no sign outside. Inside, it was full of French hipsters, and in strolled my parents looking like Thurston Howell III and his wife, the yacht club couple from Gilligan's Island, in case the name doesn't ring a bell. The bar actually had little shops and vendors inside of it, and I saw my dad sneak into one of the shops and buy my mom some trinkets as an apology. It was really sweet, and she loved the gifts, and we ended up having a great night. What my parents showed me that night was that it's very important to keep disagreements private as much as you can. It's important to not let others know of any internal strife. Besides being tacky as hell to squabble in public, which I know sounds odd coming from someone on Southern Charm, it brings others down and can snowball into something bigger. Doing things like taking a deep breath or counting to 10 are key, and I assume this is what my parents have mostly always done. My dad's gesture also taught me that whether it's a little trinket at a hipster bar or a watch from Cartier, it means the same thing. And little apologies and gestures and swallowing one's pride are always better than holding a grudge. I'd love to tell you that our Paris story had a happy ending, but that would be a lie. We still got in the car at 5 a.m. to drive to the airport, and we sat in the terminal unnecessarily for 3 hours before boarding. My dad had apologized with a trinket, but he still got his way. Not cool, Griswold. I learned another lesson about love and relationships from my sister. My sister is an amazing person. She's very smart, very even-keeled, well, most of the time. And she's someone I'd trust and confide in until the end of time. So therefore, I trust her judgment. She was dating this guy in college everyone loved, and I mean everyone. Grandparents, uncles, cousins. Since we all loved him so much, we just figured that's who she'd marry. It all seemed so traditional, and it had a family precedent, since my mom was 21 years old when she married my dad. Imagine our surprise when my sister broke up with him. How? Why? It had to be one of the hardest things she ever had to do, and I respected the hell out of her for it. She said she simply wasn't in love with him anymore, and she wasn't going to lie to herself or to him or to us about it. If she'd been born 20 or 30 years before, when the social pressures were more intense, it would have been a different story. But she had a life to live. She went to law school, she worked in Washington, D.C., where she started seeing her now husband. She practiced law in New York City for a huge firm. And now she's in Charlotte as an in-house counsel for a bank, all while raising 3 girls. The path of least resistance was never an option for her. Settling wasn't an option. Unlike me, she did end up getting married and having kids. But from her, I learned that if you're going to take the plunge into the marital abyss, better make sure it's with the right person, even if that means breaking it off with someone who, on paper, seems perfect. I myself wouldn't say I've been all that close to entering into the final frontier that is marriage, even though as I write this, I'm seeing a great girl named Taylor. I do think it's a feeling that you have to have. That or it's time to surrender, which I refuse to do, at least for now. Instead, I'll go surfing when I want and have fun, living in that place between Jeff Bridges and Leo DiCaprio. If I end up a Warren Beatty or a George Clooney, only time will tell. All I know is that I'm not ready to walk the aisle, that I view more as a plank, just yet. Maybe one day soon, though. Shep's Guide to Dating 101. Disclaimer, this is the ultimate do-as-I-say, not-as-I-do list. I am not a seasoned or serial dater. Number 1. Girls are just as insecure, clumsy, and desirous to make out as we are. If anyone single is at the bar with friends, chances are they want to meet someone. Number 2. Stay away from Instagram models, or better yet, the you can't sit with us type. They're the sort who are always looking over your shoulder for a better deal. Number 3. Give everyone a chance. But if someone shows you who they are and you don't like it, don't think that change is on the horizon. If someone does a couple of uncool things, you may still be into them, but keep reminding yourself about the things you witnessed. Number 4. Don't project into the future too much. This is hard to do, and I've fallen prey to it many times. But talking yourself out of something before it happens is very easy but really stupid sometimes. Sounds cliched, but take it one day/week at a time. Number 5. Jealousy is a very ugly emotion, but can also be a useful tool. I've definitely been a little negligent on a particular night out with a girl I like. And when you look across the room and she's smiling and chatting with another guy, it can snap you back into shape. It's a razor's edge, though. Sometimes you have to let your significant other know, like the Beyoncé song says, don't you ever for a second get to thinking you're irreplaceable. Number 6. Don't juggle girls/boys after 2 or 3 months or after you've had the DTR talk, whichever comes first. It's bad karma and bad for the soul. P.S. I'm sure the time limit I've given is different for many, but this seems like industry standard. Number 7. Communicate without being annoying. I can't stress this enough. No one is a mind reader. Don't be pissed if you expected an unspoken or implied outcome to go your way and it doesn't. Number 8. If you are single, enjoy yourself. You're only young and good-looking once. There's a saying that age 50, we all get the face we deserve. A shrill and overly guarded person doesn't age well. Number 9. If you make it so that your happiness is tied to the presence of another person, or make your life all about another person, you're doing life wrong. Being an independent person is the most attractive and important thing you can be. Number 10. Be honest. All good relationships are based on reciprocity, but it's a rare and beautiful instance where two people feel the same way about each other. If one party senses that the chasm between your feelings is too wide, then be honest. It'll hurt them for a bit, but they'll respect you and you can possibly remain friends. I take pride in not having ill feelings with any of my former girlfriends. My theory is we spent so many good times together, how could we be mad about it? But that all hinges on honesty. Number 11. In honor of Spinal Tap, I'm turning it up to 11. Read books and keep up with the news. Know what's happening in the world. There is nothing more unattractive to me than someone who doesn't know who Jeff Bezos is, or who their senators are, or what river the Allies had to cross when they were closing in on Berlin. Answer, the Rhine. Also, watch good, funny movies like Best in Show and This is Spinal Tap. Like I said, maybe this is just me, but this is my book, so I'm officially enforcing these as strict laws of dating. Movies that made me cry. As I've divulged in this chapter, I cry at movies, often. I am not ashamed. I'm so not ashamed that here is an extensive list of a few that get me every time. Number 1, Field of Dreams. When Costner says, "Hey Dad, wanna have a catch?" I just break down, every damn time. I think this is because my dad grew up in Europe and never learned to throw a baseball, which was fine. My mom threw with me, actually, but she had a terrible arm. Maybe that's why I cry. Number 2, Terms of Endearment. Shirley MacLaine, Jack Nicholson, Deborah Winger. I won't reveal too much, but just know that you're a monster if you don't cry when you watch this one. Number 3, Gandhi. I was watching this the other night, and when Gandhi starts fasting and his loved ones are pleading with him to eat, I actually looked over and saw my dad well up, and he rarely cries at movies. Number 4, Lonesome Dove. My favorite work of fiction and a great TV series starring Ricky Schroeder, and Robert Duvall, Tommy Lee Jones, Angelica Houston, Diane Lane. No spoilers, but let's just say it'll make even the most hard-hearted, burly, stone-faced man cry. Number 5, City of God. A great Brazilian film, just see it. Number 6, all right, fine, The Notebook. Taylor, who I mentioned before, is going to be pissed because she always wants to watch this with me and I usually avoid it. I was trying to get laid years ago and I watched this because I thought it might just work as a seduction technique. It didn't because the poor girl ended up consoling me for half an hour before asking me to leave. Number 7, Braveheart. I cry a few times during this movie, but the big moment is when Mel Gibson cries, "Freedom!" It's part sadness, part inspiration. Number 8, Weekend at Bernie's. When Bernie dies and then when he goes water skiing. Number 9, A Beautiful Mind. When Russell Crowe wins the Nobel Peace Prize and addresses his wife. Heartfelt stuff. Number 10, Marley and Me. Good God, I could not stop at the end. Number 11, Up. The first 5 minutes had me ugly crying, and I know I'm not alone on that. Number 12, Legends of the Fall. When Pitt's dad writes, "I am happy" on a chalkboard. I really could go on and on. I'm an emotional movie watcher and book reader, so sue me. Chapter 7, The Ugly American. Way before I came along, many of my above-average, exceedingly impressive family members traveled the world because they were fighting world wars, alongside General Patton, no less, heading up global corporations overseas, big game hunting, or meeting foreign dignitaries. When it comes to traveling, or anything, really, they were all way more accomplished than yours truly. I was always going to do things differently, though, so being a below-average progeny doesn't bother me. One of the benefits of living a life where you're striving for average is a lack of stress about things that don't matter, like being above average. Even so, I was always inspired by my family members' wild travel tales. We used to sit around the living room and beg both of my grandfathers to tell stories about the war, like the times they withstood a heavy enemy barrage of mortar shells in the Ardennes or stormed the beaches at Iwo Jima. While I have never stormed the beaches in a dangerous world war, I have danced on a beach at Koh Phan Yang in Thailand until 7 a.m. with a guy named Victor and his two Canadian girlfriends. I did it for my country and for my fellow man. I'm not trying to brag, really I'm not, but I'm 40 and I've been around the world. And when my dad attempts to regale slash impress me with stories about his exploits, whether foreign or domestic, I just have to shake my head. Yes, my relatives traveled, but their adventures were pretty tame. As in, oh wow, you guys lied and told some girls you had a private plane once at a wedding? I've literally never been to a wedding where I didn't lie and claim I had a jet, a speedboat, and or a dune buggy at my disposal. I also bet my dad and his friends never sang Lou Bega's Mambo No. 5 to a horse in the French Alps and then rode that horse into the hills, bareback, with the police chief's daughter. I think not. If I recall, her name was Angela, or Pamela, or was it Sandra? Maybe it was Rita. Who knows? What matters is that we had a great time. My maternal grandfather traveled because of his naval duties. He was on both fronts during World War II, but once his war was won, you could barely get him to leave Alabama, let alone the United States. And as much as I love Gramps, I think I'm more like my dad's dad, Papa, when it comes to exploration. I love seeing different cultures and meeting people in other countries. Debauchers, not dignitaries. And as soon as I got a taste of it, travel became a major part of my life. It makes me feel alive and free and all those cliches that are cliches because they're true. On the other hand, I also love having a solid home base, getting back, recharging, sleeping until noon in my own bed and home, and watching movies on the couch all day if the mood strikes. But on occasion, I love to get out of Dodge. By the way, this saying comes from the old West Kansas town, Dodge City, where there was gambling, prostitution, and gunfights. It sounds awesome, but one must get out every now and then to maintain sanity. I need to see the world and look for other dodges, and I guess roaming the globe is in my blood. I'd like to think my inherent capacity for boredom mixed with my thirst for adventure allows for just the right amount of travel in my life. My dad and his siblings grew up in Europe because of my grandfather's job as an international manager for Armco Steel. And my dad has a habit of breaking out his fluent Italian whenever he comes across a native. My siblings and I love to tease him whenever we are at an Italian restaurant in a strip mall in South Carolina and he starts speaking the language to order spaghetti. Maybe we make fun of him because we're jealous, which is a confession that should give him a lot of satisfaction. Damn it, you're welcome, Dad. Because of his experiences, my dad has always been a huge proponent of his kids traveling the world and broadening their horizons. As vast and diverse as America is, you truly become a better person, and your appreciation of your own country sometimes grows when you see other cultures and meet the locals. Besides, traveling becomes part of your identity. Suddenly at a dinner party, you can talk about living in Dubai or Buenos Aires or wherever your travels take you, and then you become, like the Dos Equis guy, the most interesting man in the world, and you have them right in the palm of your well-traveled hand. Right this second, I can imagine some of your eyes starting to roll as you say, yeah, it's easy for you to travel, Shep. If I had the finances, I would roam the globe too, asshole. Well, in part you're right. But it's not like I'm staying in five-star resorts and palaces when I travel, and there's always a way to do it cheaply, or cheap-ish. The point is, it's a big world out there, and seeing it should be a priority. At least, it is for me. Walden writer Henry David Thoreau's big travel experience wasn't overseas. It was to a cabin in Massachusetts, but he wrote, I went to the woods because I wished to live deliberately, to front only the essential facts of life, and see if I could not learn what it had to teach, and not, when I came to die, discover that I had not lived. I wanted to live deep and suck out all the marrow of life, to live so sturdily and Spartan-like as to put to rout all that was not life, to cut a broad swath and shave close. This attitude has always resonated with me, as have these lines from another writer hero of mine, Jack Kerouac. The only people for me are the mad ones, the ones who are mad to live, mad to talk, mad to be saved, desirous of everything at the same time, the ones that never yawn or say a commonplace thing, but burn, 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 like fabulous yellow Roman candles. Before you roll your eyes, yes, I know these are some of the most quoted passages in the history of literature, and I'm not proving my mental acuity by sharing them here. They're popular for a reason, though, and I like them. Thoreau and Kerouac seem like they were vastly different people, but the goal is the same, to learn more about themselves by experiencing a different reality than most of their peers and fellow citizens, to break the mold, to seek adventures large and small, to drink multiple beers and Jaeger bombs with the locals. Well, maybe not Thoreau. This resonates with me in so many ways. Yes, I understand that traveling the world isn't as maverick or groundbreaking today as it once was back before Airbnb and Google Maps. And I also understand that very few places are still pristine, since they have been ruined, depending on who you ask, by commercial travel. Even Walden Pond does group tours. This doesn't make travel any less important to my life, which is why I will now regale you with stories of my travels. From the cobblestone streets of South America to the gleaming towers of Dubai. There will be adventure, there will be debauchery, and there will be even some occasional enlightenment. Quick disclaimer. When it comes to travel, or anything else really, I am not a role model. So if you're looking for Thoreau-like inspiration or Anthony Bourdain-esque punk rock deep thoughts, please kick off your flip-flops, grab yourself a beer, and settle in for a glimpse of Shepland on the road. You might not reach enlightenment, but you will have fun. Side note, honestly, this chapter is really why I wanted to write this book. I started writing early on in my travels, mainly because some of the stories were so ridiculous, they just had to be shared. So I started emailing all my buddies, and then lightly censoring and sending those emails to my family. Then the emails led me to writing essays. So, included here are a few abridged versions of my travel writing over the years. Maybe one day, when the world and my mom and dad are ready, I'll really open the floodgates. For now, here's a taste. When the travel comes to you. The first indication that my father wanted his children to inherit his wanderlust was the fact that the Roses were VIP members of the local Rotary Club. Because the club is an international service organization, we hosted exchange students as if we were operating a free hostel, except we had air conditioning and non-communal bathrooms. I suppose it was my parents' way of bringing the culture to us. I remember having a little trepidation when, as a 13-year-old, I was told that a 17-year-old Brazilian was coming to live in our guest room and attend our local high school. My fear quickly disappeared when Fabia entered our lives. She was such a shy, nervous, and ultimately wonderful addition to our family. It also didn't hurt that she was beautiful. I was secretly in love with her. She would